and goes to Birmingham, Alabama, and he checks in under the name of John Raines. He sells his car back in the States, and he takes the train to Birmingham. And he opens a safe deposit box at the Birmingham National Bank, August the 28th. In that city, he receives a letter from Rowell, and he spends almost $2,000 cash for a car. Rowell keeps the duplicate keys to the car, to the Mustang. And
so you would suspect that Rowell might have some interest in that
car.
Well,
there's a part ownership, yes. There's a part ownership in that. He passes his Alabama driving test. While in Birmingham, he has a little time from August through September until October. And he begins to take dancing lessons and joins the Canadian Lonely Hearts Club. He has a correspondence going back up there. And he takes a locksmith course by correspondence, and then he orders some very expensive camera equipment, Kodak projector, a camera with a zoom lens, and remote cables. And he's fitted out with a lot of, it's a Kodak dual projector, a Kodak Super 8 camera with zoom lens, an HBI combination 8mm super splicer, 20-foot remote control cable. This boy never tells what he does with all that camera equipment, but he orders all of that through the mail. He has a lot of things going through the mail, but nobody is checking or looking for this particular person.
All of this in addition to buying a $2,000 car. And all of this has come out of his income as a dishwasher at $400 a month for 3 months.
He claims that Rowell is supporting him. The important thing is he's being financed for something, even just drug traffic. But how drug traffic connects with being behind the Lorraine Motel is it questionable. You see, it's possible that you can make that money and spend that money bringing drugs, say, from Canada, the United States, and down to Mexico and back and forth like he was doing. That is possible. But the connection of him being at the Lorraine Motel when he's never been in that town or been political or involved in any political groups, he's just doing a drug thing. To kill Martin Luther King, he wasn't in a drug scene, you see?
Was any effort made to find out who this Rowell is or to track him down?
Well, I have a list of the connections of Rowell. The researchers have tracked them down. The FBI won't. The FBI won't talk to us. James Ray leaves Birmingham, Alabama, and goes to the Mexican border at Nuevo Laredo, and then Acapulco, and Puerto Vallarta, and Guadalajara, and he spends 19 days at the resort hotels. In November, he goes to Los Angeles and does some more dancing lessons, and then he leaves for New Orleans to meet Rowell in New Orleans. He met him in Birmingham once, and he's to meet him in New Orleans. And this is the trip to New Orleans that Louis Lomax was interested in. He is a writer, had a radio program in Los Angeles, and he was interested in the death of Martin Luther King. And he was putting together the Rowell scene in New Orleans, and that was the connection to the Canal Street and Lee Harvey Oswald.
Where's Louis Lomax now?
His car was turned over in New Mexico, and he was dead, and the researchers have every reason to believe he was killed, along with the many, many other people who get too snoopy into this particular subject. So in 1968, this was December, he left for New Orleans, and in January 1968, James Ray shows up in Los Angeles at a self-improvement specialist, the International Society of Hypnosis. And this is very important because of the Sirhan case, the mind lock. He shakes his head when you get into anything regarding the Ambassador Hotel or the whole scene. And he seems to be programmed to not remember anything that happened. He just shakes his head.
Yeah, I know Sirhan admitted a lot of incriminating things, but there are huge blank areas in his mind where he can only shake his head and he can't give you details on things. He will admit shooting Senator Robert Kennedy. He thinks he did.
Well,
but there are so many areas where he just can't remember this and he can't remember that about things that happened up to that point.
That's right. Well, he remembers.
This is what's led to the speculation that he was kind of like
a
hypnotic robot or something.
His contacts before. That's right. Everything is just, he's shaking his head. When James Ray was arrested in London, he had the book, How to Cash In on Your Hidden Memory Powers. And I think that if his memory stays hidden, he'll cash in.
Yeah.
They already made a deal, you know, for his parole. And I think one reason for the news to say that Martin Luther King was killed by a sniper is to let the next generation of the people coming up who affect changes not get too excited if he's out. You know, the name isn't heavy in people's minds, and they're not going to want to associate it with this particular crime. Well, he has this book, How to Cash In on Your Hidden Memory Powers, and then he goes to bartending school. This is in Los Angeles in January. Now, he was in Los Angeles from January to March, but there's an interim there where somebody else with the same name that he was using was in Birmingham, Alabama, because the Standard station has there were green stamps in his car traced to the gas station in Birmingham, Alabama, and the gas station fixed this white Mustang for clutch trouble, and he had an automatic, and this was a clutch problem. There were two white Mustangs that were identical, and one was filled with cigarette butts, and one didn't have any, he didn't smoke, and one had a clutch, and the other was an automatic. And while his chronology says he didn't leave Los Angeles, there was somebody receiving another driver's license there.
Well, which was the white Mustang they found at the murder scene?
I don't know.
That they connected with the murder.
I don't know. They don't identify it like there were two rifles, two guns in the Los Angeles Police Department, two serial numbers, with, you know, the two serial numbers listed, and I have different numbers attributed to Sirhan's weapon, but I don't have the license of these Mustangs. We don't know where he is, but James said he was in L.A. through this period. And in 1968, he was at a nose surgeon's, plastic surgeon, where he had his face fixed. And the surgeon didn't recognize his famous client until James Ray was arrested in England. And then when the writers and researchers went to his office, he had the after pictures of James Ray, not the before.
Now, all plastic surgeons keep a file on all their patients with before and after photographs. But by some coincidence, this specific file was missing. James Earl Ray's before pictures were missing, huh?
Yeah. Well, you know, we talk about almost every show, we bring up important parts of political assassinations and always involve some piece of evidence that was missing. So one day we'll do a whole show on evidence missing in conspiracy murder trials, just like we mentioned one item here, the surgeon's pictures of James Ray. Now, while he was having his face fixed in Los Angeles, he got a duplicate car license under the name Eric Starvo Galt. Somebody wrote and asked for another license in Montgomery, Alabama. He was in Los Angeles and had his license, and a second license was issued to Eric Starvo Galt in Montgomery, Alabama. Is everyone thoroughly confused by now? He returns to New Orleans and then Selma, Alabama, and then Birmingham and Atlanta, Georgia. Now, you see, he's never in Memphis until the day of the murder of Martin Luther King. Galt went with Rowell, his friend, in March, just a week before the murder of Martin Luther King, and bought a high-velocity rifle in Birmingham. And he left Atlanta, Georgia, in this Mustang and went to Corinth, Mississippi, and practiced with the new rifle and was using the name Galt. On April the 3rd, he checked into the Memphis, in Memphis, Tennessee, at the Rebel Motel on April the 3rd. And on April the 4th, he changed to another hotel, rooming house, behind the Lorraine Motel. Now, Martin Luther King was scheduled to stay at another place, too. And this is a source of investigation which the federal government doesn't care to go into either. And that his arrangements were switched. And they were switched by a member of the black community, a well-known part of the Martin Luther King entourage. And there are members of the Southern community, Mr. Stoner in particular, who says that Martin Luther King was killed by the FBI and by black people, friends of Martin Luther King's, that they helped them, that he set him up. And I have been given the name of a particular person as a suspect that many black people that are into this feel was the one who helped do in Martin Luther King. He did have arrangements to stay at another hotel, and it was switched to the Lorraine Motel. And it would be interesting to know, I don't have a private investigator, but it would be interesting for those people who have access, or if I have enough money someday to get somebody, to find out the exact location of the original place he was to stay, and to check out if it backed up to the Rebel Motel, where...
Yeah, because for some reason, James Earl Ray was at the Rebel, and then he changed his reservation so that he would be right across from the Lorraine.
And he was never in the town before in his life. He makes a good getaway from a police blockade and gets out of the
country. Somehow he had to be aware of the fact that Martin Luther King's hotel arrangements had been changed, that Martin Luther King would be staying at the Lorraine so that he could change his reservations and be at a nearby place.
And the day before he bought these binoculars, you know, well, who was he going to watch? Well, he had to see, he knew what he was going to do, and he stalked Martin Luther King very carefully. But he had never been in the town before, so he had to get directions. This is a conspiracy, you see. Who was moving him over to the other place because somebody had to know that Martin Luther King was changing his directions. If Ray was doing it alone, he didn't have a pipeline to where Martin Luther King switched or how he would know. Now, Martin Luther King was killed April the 4th, 1968. And then the escape attempt of James Ray begins. We first have the background of his childhood and his bungling, everything he did. Then the life of spending between $20,000 and $50,000 in the interim, in those year and a half interim, of going to Mexico, Canada, resorts, Puerto Vallarta, on the beach, bartending, dancing, contacts back and forth, thousands of miles on his
car.
And
at no time is there any evidence of his having been employed other than that 3 months, a little over 3 months, as a dishwasher at $400 a month.
And he was never...
And he spent something like $50,000.
Back and forth around the country. But then he left and went to Atlanta, Georgia. And he left his car in Atlanta, Georgia, after Martin Luther King was dead. And there were no fingerprints in the car at all. It was white, clean of fingerprints, but this particular car was one that had cigarette butts, and he didn't smoke.
Did they mention whether it was stick shift or automatic?
I believe that this was the stick shift, and his was... I have to look that up at home. I have
all
those
details.
Is this
where they found the green stamps in that car?
Later, after, yeah.
Oh,
and they dated back to the earlier time that he'd been there when he said he was in Los Angeles. And there was another person that used this car that had the set of keys, so we really don't know who was using the car.
But they were able to take the numbers on the green stamps that were found in the car and trace that back to the service station and find out that those green stamps had been given for a clutch job.
A clutch job.
So that would indicate that this is the car that had the stick shift.
Yeah, and there were two identical Mustangs involved. Well, he left his car with not one fingerprint, and he took the bus to Cincinnati. And in that interim, he also went to Mexico. And then he's to go to Canada. Now, after Martin Luther King is killed, the borders aren't checked, and Canada and Mexico would be two logical places to look for the suspect of Martin Luther King, and he was in both places.
Yeah, I would say after a major killing like that, you would think that he was moving around awfully freely.
Yeah, absolutely, and then he goes to Canada, Toronto, and he gets a birth certificate under the name of Bridgman.
How did he get that?
I don't know. It was delivered to him. The story goes, to cover up the issuance of this, that he went to the library and looked up the newspaper records of when a particular man was born to fit his name. But this would be pretty slick. He got passport photo under the name of Bridgman, bought theatrical supplies, disguise kits, and using Sneed as an alias, he also got a passport under that name. And he used that one, and not the Bridgman one. He had these official passports, but he chose the one of Sneed, and he went on his way to London. And he got to London May the 7th, and he flew the next day to Lisbon, to the Hotel Portugal. And then he went to the Texas Bar and the California Bar. Those were the saloons, not the bar associations he didn't turn himself in. The Texas Bar and the California Bar. And he went to the Canadian embassy there, and he changed his passport. There was a spelling on that. He changed it to Sneed. And then he went back to London. He was with a company with another man. People who were with him in London said he was sarcastic about the death of Robert Kennedy. He was with a blonde American. On June the 8th, he was in the London airport. He'd come back from Portugal, and he didn't intend to stay in London. And he had a ticket, and he was en route either to Brussels or Paris. Now, it seems to me that when he was arrested that they would know where he's going because the ticket said one or the other. Like, he isn't going either to Munich or Florence. I mean, if he was arrested with an air ticket and he's about to catch, it would be easy to trace and maybe follow up who would receive him at the other end. But that was never gone into either, and he was arrested and he was brought home.
He was arrested by...
by Scotland Yard.
Not the FBI.
No. And then when he was arrested, he had the name of three famous attorneys in the United States to call upon. And Mr. Haynes was chosen as the attorney for... he's from the South, and he was chosen as the attorney for Martin Luther King until 2 days before the hearing. And then he was discharged. He was going to say that James Ray was innocent of the killing. Haynes can see no connection between the bullet that's in Martin Luther King and the particular gun that was used behind the hotel.
Uh-huh. Now we come to a real mystery, because after all of this traveling around and all this creation of a tangle of confusion so that it would be almost impossible to trace him back, there's suspicion that maybe all of this cover-up was done and James Earl Ray actually was not the killer.
That, oh, That's right. And now I want to suggest that everybody get the Esquire magazine of this month, March issue. It's a marvelous article, and I would just wish I had time to read the whole thing on the air, which I don't. It's impossible. It's called Are You Sure Who Killed Martin Luther King?
And that's in the March issue of Esquire magazine.
Yeah, and people should get it, buy the Esquire, or go to the library and Xerox the 6 pages, because it goes into a lot of the chronology that I've talked about Martin Luther King, and it goes into the fact that Mr. Haynes wanted to represent Martin Luther King, but 2 days...
And James Earl Ray, right?
James Earl Ray. I keep saying Martin Luther King. 2 days before the trial was to take place, Percy Forman from Houston, Texas, was set in. And then James Ray pleaded an altogether different story.
Did James Earl Ray request Percy Forman?
Nobody knows how Percy Forman got in on the case. And because Houston, Texas is such a center of CIA funds and institutions and foundations, it would be very important to know if Percy Forman in any way is related to these CIA foundations. I know that Leon Jaworski, the president of the American Bar Association, is on the board of directors of a CIA foundation in Houston, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman, Sarah Hughes, the lawyer who swore in Lyndon Johnson, is a board of directors, a lawyer for the CIA foundation in Houston, Texas, the one who administered the oath to Johnson after the killing of John Kennedy. But at this hearing, they had about 19-minute hearing before the judge where James Earl Ray gave up his chance for a trial. James Ray said, he spoke up and interrupted the judge, and he was very angry. And he said, Your Honor, I would like to say something. I don't want to change anything I've said. I want to enter one other thing, and that is I can't agree with Mr. Clark. Ramsey Clark was the Attorney General of the United States who kept insisting publicly that the King assassination was the work of one man acting alone. Ramsey Clark got on the air the day after the Martin Luther King assassination and said there was no conspiracy at all. That's the head of the Justice Department, the whole United States.
But James Earl Ray in court said, I don't agree with that.
That's right. But the head of the Justice Department, the district, you know, of the whole United States, didn't even have a suspect. And he's telling you there was absolutely no conspiracy, and even the Almanac of 1970 tells you about the obvious conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King.
Well, at the time, James Earl Ray said in court, Your Honor, I don't agree with Ramsey Clark. Did anybody say, well, what do you mean?
Well, what?
Did anybody question him
to
what the conspiracy in his mind was? Or
Ray spoke up before Ray could be hushed. It was clear that he was disagreeing with Clark and Canale, who was a chief prosecutor, in saying there was no conspiracy. And his outburst subsequently was to add to public confusion over this point.
I would think so, yes.
Yeah, he was saying, I don't agree with the fact that there was no conspiracy. Now, the case lasted 144 minutes. And Esquire says it has been established that the prosecution at this time is not in possession of enough evidence to indict anyone as a co-conspirator in this case. And, of course, this is not conclusive evidence. There was no conspiracy. But they promised to open up the case if ever a conspiracy appeared. But so many researchers are finding evidence of a conspiracy, but this prosecutor hasn't found it yet. So there's nothing to open up. And if the FBI hasn't found it, then they're never going to open it up.
They don't appear to be looking too hard. They haven't checked into any of these obvious things that would occur to every listener who's hearing this program.
Well, it seems so obvious that now the law firm of Haynes and Haynes, their father and son, are in Birmingham, Alabama. And Mr. Haynes said he was nominated in London as being a second choice to represent James Earl Ray. And Mr. Haynes was not a friend of Martin Luther King. As a former mayor of Birmingham, Alabama, he had his troubles with the black leader, and he successfully defended white Southerners in race cases. But Haynes knew Ray inside and out. And I'm quoting Esquire, that Haynes got the largest share of his earnings of a book that was to be written about Ray, that Huey was writing, Bradford Huey. And it says, Haynes had no reason to assert that the Martin Luther King assassination was a conspiracy, except that he believes it. He no longer represents Ray in any capacity. He is an old FBI man himself, and he's able to look at evidence with an absolutely detached eye. And yet he says with a fervent conviction, I'll state flatly right now that James Earl Ray did not fire the shot that killed Martin Luther King. There were real plotters. He was a dupe in that conspiracy. Haynes, here's a lawyer who has represented the people not sympathetic to Martin Luther King, an ex-FBI man examining the evidence. He claims the bullet that killed Dr. King, a perfect evidence bullet, was not fired from the gun that Ray bought, and he contends that the evidence in the doorway dropped was not dropped by Ray, but by somebody else, and that the state's case against Ray was not sufficient for a first-degree murder charge, and he has confidence that if he had gone to the jury, he would have had a mistrial.
In at least his opinion, there was not sufficient evidence even to bring Ray to trial.
He said, they asked him who had the brains, the intelligence, and the know-how to conceive this plot. And Haynes said only two groups could do it, the black militants and the CIA. Well, up to this point, Mr. Haynes never gave the black people any brains or intelligence for anything.
Mm-hmm.
So he all of a sudden he thinks they can conceive a plot that goes beyond the FBI and Reagan, you know, they can manage this whole thing, that the black people could move a man like James Ray to kill Martin Luther King. That's hardly possible. But the other choice, he says, is the CIA. And he says it sounds terrible for an old patriotic fellow like me to talk about the CIA, but that's the way he feels it, and he feels that this plot, it was a conspiracy and that Ray was used. He says James Earl Ray did not fire the shot. He was a man who loved to go out at night, sip vodka and orange juice, go with the girls at the bar, pick them up. He made a good escape from the penitentiary, covered his tracks. He was living good. He was within the clutches of the law. He owed them 18 years, and he got away. And he said, they're using James Earl Ray. The gun that he bought in Birmingham at the Arrow Marine Supply was taken from Ray on Tuesday night in a little motel in Mississippi prior to the shooting of Dr. King on Thursday. And Ray never saw that gun again. He was given a slip of paper and said, check in at the rooming house, 422 South Main Street in Memphis at 3 o'clock Thursday afternoon. Now, this is what Haynes is saying, and he spent more time with Ray than any other single person.
Who gave him that slip of paper that told him to check into?
James Ray told his attorney, Haynes, that he got a slip of paper. And as was typical of James Earl Ray, he got lost. He parked his car a mile and a half from the rooming house. He got there at 3:20. He checked in, and his contact came to him and dispatched him up the street to get binoculars. He brought the binoculars back, laid them in the suitcase, and he was told to get his car and bring it down and put it in front of the rooming house. Go down and have a beer in Jim's Grill underneath here and wait for me. And the only witness to the state had to this particular case was a Charlie Stevens. And Haynes says that Stevens was drunk all the time. He was no more witness than I was. This is Haynes in the Esquire article. He was no more witness than I was. And Haynes had another witness, Stevens' friend, whose name was Grace Walden. And her description of who left the place after the murder of Martin Luther King no way fit James Earl Ray. But Grace Walden disappeared and was committed to a state mental hospital, and Haynes interviewed there. And Haynes said about the gun, that is not the gun that fired and shot Martin Luther King, and the state could never show that it did. And this particular woman is locked up as being crazy. We don't know where she is now. She was never seen. He saw her at this mental institution. And because the man...
A witness who could testify that the man who left the murder scene was not James Earl Ray.
Yeah.
And she is now in a mental institution. Who committed her?
Well, you know, I don't know who committed her because there's so many unanswered questions, but if this sounds far-fetched to the listeners that a woman could be of value in pointing out the man who left the rooming house and that she's committed, I have to refer back to the show we did, was it a week ago, on Thomas Noguchi, the coroner in Los Angeles.
That's exactly what they attempted to do with him.
He was a doctor, a man who went through medical school, who did the autopsy on Robert Kennedy, and it was in June 1968, and the Board of Supervisors in the city of Los Angeles gave him a commendation for this wonderful autopsy that he did, was so thorough and complete, and it stated that Robert Kennedy was murdered 1 inch from the back of the head by a gunman standing an inch from the back of the head. And 1 year later, the same Board of Supervisors in the city of Los Angeles fired him from being a coroner on the grounds that he was insane, and they had a list of charges that he danced over the bodies and laughed and giggled and took drugs and hoped the planes would crash, large jets.
They had a whole parade of witnesses saying just really outrageous things.
That's right, and fired him, a medical doctor, for being insane. So if you can get away with doing that, Thomas Taguchi was later restated because he got...
Well, he spent every penny of his resources in defending himself against these charges.
He had money and a family and savings, and he had to use it all up to prove that he wasn't crazy.
But apparently this poor woman, who was a witness to the Martin Luther King murder witness...
There's no one like Godfrey Isaac, the attorney that represented, Thomas Taguchi in Los Angeles. There's no one that spoke up or represented this woman and found out why she's locked away. And Haynes says that she's locked away. And J.B. Stoner, the attorney in the South for the National States Rights Party, an admitted racist, he's in the anti-Jewish party, he hates the Jews, he hates the blacks, he wishes all the Jews were removed from this country. Stoner's campaign manager was Jerry L. Ray, brother of James Earl Ray, and he was always marked for violence and followed around. He was arrested for shooting a 17-year-old boy recently. Mr. Stoner is now a candidate for the United States Senate, but Mr. Stoner said that he visits Ray all the time. He goes into the jail, and he has access to Ray now. He has become one of the lawyers of James Earl Ray for the National States Rights Party, and he said, in quotes, "Ray was a pawn, a decoy in a conspiracy planned and carried out by the agencies of the United States government, and the conspirators were using some of King's own people." They asked him specifically, "Do you mean the FBI was responsible for King's death?" And he says, "Yes." Stoner has been warring with the FBI for years. They came to him as an undercover agent and offered him $25,000 to kill King at one time, and he turned it down. And Stoner mentions the government agencies, and Mr. Haynes mentions them. So if Mae Bressel is saying this, it's not that I'm after any particular group. There's another political spectrum at the other side, way over at the other side of where I'm thinking, who are saying these things.
And all of these statements that Mae has been making, which may be really blowing your mind, are in Esquire magazine, the March edition. There's about a 6-page article there that you can pick up and read for yourself, in a national publication that says all these things that Mae has been reading here.
Are you sure who killed Martin Luther King? That's the title.
And the author of that article is...
Bynum Shaw.
Bynum Shaw. Are you sure who killed Martin Luther King? I think after this past hour, we're sure of one thing. Who didn't kill Martin Luther King? And we're sure that aside from a few research specialists and a handful of concerned people around the country, nobody is really trying to find out who killed Martin Luther King, as nobody is really too concerned about a thorough investigation into who killed Robert Kennedy, who killed John Fitzgerald Kennedy,
let alone
people like Louis Lomax.
Well, a few hundred others we can name.
Malcolm X and so on down the line. Let alone the little people who have died... innocent people.
Because they happen to be in the hallway of a building.
Or who have been committed to mental institutions or fates even worse.
So while you tend your gardens this week, think about what you hear and try to be political as well as horticultural, you know. Combine the two. They go hand in glove.
Okay, we'll be back again next week with Dialogue Assassination with Mae Bressel. And Mae, you said something about... perhaps devoting a whole program to provocateurs.
Yeah, next week I think I'll take Louis Tacco in Los Angeles and Frank Martinez from the Mexican-American community and show the effects of the death of Martin Luther King, the riots that followed, and the deaths and the pillaging and murder. When Martin Luther King was killed, the effect was to have Spiro Agnew as the law and order candidate of vice president. And in order to get that, you use provocateurs to set fire to buildings. And we'll talk about the follow-up of James Ray in terms of the provocateurs that brought the chaos and the riots that brought more repression following the political effect of the death of Martin Luther King in this country.
As a newsman, I'm aware that quite frequently at peace demonstrations or demonstrations of various natures where people will outrage the general public by desecrating the American flag, urinating on the flag, things like that. You're properly outraged by acts like this, and quite frequently these acts are committed by agents of your government. And the reason they're doing it is to outrage you and to make you angry with the groups that these people have infiltrated and become associated with.
And then you allow them more weapons to gain more control and more wiretapping and bugging and more candidates.
And so instead of identifying it as an agent of your government who's doing these things, you say those Black Panthers have to be stopped, those SDS people have to be stopped and all this sort of thing, and you give the government more power to come down on them without realizing that that kind of power is very, very dangerous and could be turned on you.
This faceless government, yeah.
So that's what we'll be discussing next week on Dialogue Assassination with Mae Brussel.